The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening, what I'd like to do is to hear your concerns, your questions. So if you have any questions about the practice we do, or meditation, or about Buddhism, or these teachings, this evening's a chance for you to ask them. And if you have no questions, then either we're in really good shape, or there's a problem. Yes, and if you could use the mic, please.
I'm kind of new to meditation.
So the way you use the mic is you want to be able to, this is for everybody's sake, you want to be able to hear yourself coming through the speakers. So it's a little bit strange because usually you don't listen to yourself that way. And the way to do it is to have the mic really close to your chin and maybe even a little bit horizontally.
Is this better?
Yeah, you can, yeah.
Okay. I'm sort of new to meditation. So I actually have like 101 questions, but I'll just ask one. It's just, what does it mean when people talk about enlightenment? And how does someone know if they're enlightened? Does someone else tell them, or do they just declare it?
Great. It's a good question. And since you have 101 questions, I'll start by saying that there's an ancient teaching in Buddhism that you create good karma for yourself if you ask questions. So... it's a reasonable question to ask about enlightenment, since the Buddha was enlightened, and enlightenment's held up as kind of one of the goals of practice. As one of the kind of classic central teachings or goals of Buddhism, you can well imagine that there's many different teachings about it. I mean, Buddhism's been around for 2,500 years, and so there's all these different schools of Buddhism, different, to emphasize in a different way, different opinions about what it is. And not everyone agrees on what exactly it is. But the simplest way of understanding what the Buddha's enlightenment is, enlightenment is a Western word. The two words that are used most commonly in India, in the ancient time, is either bodhi, which means to be awake, meaning that most people are kind of asleep. They're ignorant, they don't really see what's going on. And so someone who's enlightened has become awake, and they don't. They really see and understand deeply the nature of the heart, their mind, how it functions, so that they can attain vimutti. And vimutti is the second word that's used, and that means freedom. And so enlightenment, in the one of the most classic ways of describing enlightenment, is that it involves freedom. And it's freedom from compulsion, freedom from the kind of limitations we put on our lives through how we think and how we behave and how we attitudes we have. And so someone who's enlightened has no contractions, no clinging, no fear. They have no greed. They have no hate. Because they've been liberated from these kinds of psychological forces which limit the freedom of the heart. And so that's the classic goal, is to attain that kind of freedom. And so someone's enlightened has that freedom. Now, how do you know if you have that? One of the ways you know that you have a taste of it, also the tradition says that there are degrees that you can attain. So there are degrees in which you can start attaining these kinds of freedom from these kinds of limitations that the mind creates for ourselves. And one of the ways you know is that you don't suffer so much. And so there's a progressively less suffering. And so one of the ways that vimutti, this freedom, is defined is freedom from suffering. And so so that happens more most people happens progressively. It isn't like just a big bang theory of enlightenment. And then you're done with suffering. You go on to other more important things. But rather it's a progressive process, and you can feel and know that you're not suffering some of the ways you've suffered before, and that feels quite different. And one of the things also it said we're freed from is we're freed from the neurotic attachment to needing to be anybody or to have a particular identity. And so one of the freedoms of someone who gets more and more enlightened is they're freed from, they also become free from needing to be enlightened. So someone who really is caught up and think, I'm enlightened, and boy, better look at me, and I have stripes, you know, on my shoulder, you can pretty much bet they're not. And so some people, teachers say there's a tendency as people get more mature in this practice, have more freedom, that it becomes less and less important for them whether they are or are not enlightened, because they don't look at the world that way. It's not the reference point. But when we're suffering a lot and struggling in our lives, then the idea of some kind of relief from that, freedom from that, can seem really appealing. And so then, and because many people are very concerned about self and proving themselves and getting stripes and getting recognized, and the idea of becoming an enlightened person becomes is a goal that they often refer to. Does that make sense, or is that okay? Or
yeah.
It's a complicated topic.
But are there actually really enlightened people walking around?
So again, as I said, that there are degrees,
yeah.
Right? So whether there's people who are Buddhas fully enlightened, I don't know. I've never met one that I've never met anyone who I can confidently say yes, that person is fully enlightened. There are people in our wider Buddhist world, especially coming out of Southeast Asia, who believe that there are some 50 to 100 people in Thailand who are fully enlightened. But again, I don't know, and I've never met anyone. And I've met people who not just individuals, but large groups of people have said, that person is fully enlightened. And I know things about them. That I know that. And it's a little bit awkward because people say, like, oh, he's so enlightened, so great. And you know, and I don't want to say anything because you don't want to. And I know that some of their behavior is not that at all. So it teaches me sometimes there's a lot of projection onto people. Like people assume that there are these people who, especially monastics, who are really quiet. And some of them are quite mature and free. And as they get older, they get more of this aura of something. And sometimes they appear more enlightened than they actually are. I'm not saying there aren't. But what I know is that there are people who have degrees of it. And there are people, and many people, who have experienced degrees of freedom that are very, very meaningful and powerful and has transformed and changed their lives in ways that those lives are never the same. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like a radical rebirth, radical transformation, radical stepping into a new life because of it.
So I had a question around more like the spiritual life, which is maybe sitting meditation and spending more time in nature as opposed to kind of working like a professional life, which is very busy and there's a lot, 100 things to do. And I always had that feeling earlier, I would rather, when I'm on the cushion, I would think I'd rather be working. And when I'm working, I think I'd rather be on the cushion. And I'm just wondering, like, there's limited energy, limited time, like how do you, I know you have to be meditating all the time, but it's a little bit harder in the chaotic world as opposed to, you know. So I'm just curious on two things. And generally, like, how do you think about, like, I guess allocating your time and energy? And then in general and also personally, how you made a decision to be, I mean, what if you were working? I mean, in a profession. No. What I meant, what if you're working for a startup, like 100 hours, 2 hours, 100 hours a week? Like, would that be different than what you're doing? Like, I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah, I retired early. Yeah, so, all very good questions, very relevant to the kind of lives that people, a lot of people around here live. And what to say, the you started off was to create this very strong contrast between a peaceful, quiet life, living in nature, you know, nothing to do, not working, you know, just sitting there and being Mr. Natural. You probably don't know Mr. Natural, but Mr. Natural was a comic strip character from, you know, the late 1960s. And kind of a hippie comic book. And then versus the you know, busy, you know, life. And here in Silicon Valley, we also have this example of people who work 60, 80, 90.
Well, the first one I meant more like spending more time, I guess reading the scriptures or practicing meditation or something, I guess, considered more spiritual, I guess, from a traditional perspective.
Because not just for your sake, but for many people, that this, so the people set up this contrast between two different ways. And that contrast, having that contrast really strong, is usually too idealistic and unrealistic for what happens in the real world. If you go to I've been to some of the larger monasteries in Buddhist monasteries, and I've lived in them, and the life is not sitting there under a tree, doing nothing and just meditating all the time. There's often a lot of work that has to be done. And a lot of engagement with other people, and I mean, especially here in America, I joke that one of the contributions of Buddhism to America to Buddhism is meetings. And because in Asia, you know, the monasteries are run kind of authoritarily, and so the abbot just says this is how it does, that we do things. Here in America, where we're more egalitarian, we have meetings, and boy, do they have meetings in some of these places. You know, I mean, there are people who go to meetings. You know, you know, if you work at a corporation, you know, you go to meetings all day. If you're a senior staff at Spirit Rock or senior staff at San Francisco Zen Center, you go to meetings all day. So the important thing is not your lifestyle, but how you engage in it. And it's possible to engage in being a very peaceful kind of monastic, you know, spiritual life, person can be sitting filled with greed and filled with hate and fear and never really address the important issues of their lives. And it's possible to be fully engaged in a work life and work many hours, maybe work 60 hours a week, but engage in that and work intensively in such a way, or intensively look at it as a spiritual practice, as a place for mindfulness, see the work as a mirror for yourself in some deep way, and really be transformed in the process of that work, because you've taken it on as a place for a personal transformation. And so, I prefer almost not to answer your question about, you know, how much time to allocate to meditation and studying, and how much time, you know, to do other things. I'm more interested in how do you bring a presence of mindfulness to your life that you have, that you don't get distracted in that life, you don't get lost and consumed in that life, and you lose touch with yourself. But the opposite happens. You engage in that life so that you stay in touch, you are aware, you stay mindful, you don't get lost in your thoughts and your ambitions or in your drama of the life. I think so that our places of work become our meditation centers, and not literally so, but become our monasteries, the places where we get transformed. And I know too many people who think that real practice happens on retreat, real practice happens somewhere else. And so the question is, how do we make real practice happen for those people who work 40 hours a week or a big chunk of their days, their week? How do we make that as meaningful to engage in practice as going to a monastery, going on a retreat? That's what's interesting. And so for that, we have to look at our intentions. And I think looking at what our deepest intentions are is very important. I think that people who really find that their daily life and work and, you know, all aspects of life really becomes their place of transformation are very clear about their intention. They have a very clear intention or sense of purpose of what their life's going to be about. And they've really reflected deeply about their intention. And chances are that if a person really wants to use their work, wherever it might be, as a place for personal transformation, as kind of a path to liberation, they're probably not, their purpose of working is probably not to get rich. It's probably not to get status, probably not to, you know, there's many, many things that get promotions or all kinds of things. It's probably not even to get security. But probably the primary intention, motivation, if you really want that place to be a place of practice, has to be to do the practice itself. Has to be a place where we're going to try to cultivate mindfulness, compassion. We try to use that to understand and reflect what's deeply what's going on for us. To engage in the work in such a way that we leave work maybe more calm, more centered than we came. And I worked, after I lived for a few years in a monastery, I went to work as a fast order cook at a vegetarian restaurant. And my training in the monastery taught me how to engage fully in the work of being a cook so that I would leave the intense job feeling more refreshed and more focused and centered than I did when I started the day because of how I did the work. And so the intention has to be there, and the intention has to stay in the forefront. This is the purpose. This is what I'm doing. I'm not going to sacrifice that intention. I'm not going to lose that intention. Then I think that so much follows in the wake of having that clear intention. But I think a lot of people are not so clear about their intention. And a lot of people might have a clear intention, but they don't have much energy behind it. You know, like, oh yeah, I'd like to get enlightened, that'd be good. And, you know, I'll get around to it someday. And, you know, you know. So one of the interesting questions is, imagine there's an anthropologist from Mars who comes to study you. And they don't, and they can like watch all your behavior throughout the day and throughout the week and everything. And what would they conclude was the most important part of your life, that what your life was all about? And so, some of them would write back, oh, they seem to sit in front of this altar, this square screen. Light shines out, and that's, you know, that seems to be the purpose of life, is to kind of have this light shining. You know, and then there's the people who watch television, you know. So, so for example, in terms of purpose, what's important for you? How many hours a day do you watch television or watch television on the computer? How many time, hours of the day do you surf, you know, kind of mindlessly the web for different things? And how often during the day do you check the news on the web? You know, what do you do? And is that really... Well, how, you know, if you step back and look at the wider picture of the day, the wider picture of what your life is about, is that what your intention is? Your sense of purpose in life is to go and check and see the next update on the news or to watch one more TV program? If you spent as much time as you, for those, some of you, maybe some of you don't watch TV, but if you spent half the time, a quarter of the time you spend watching TV or using the computer for recreation, and use that for the things you talked about, meditation you know, maybe studying Buddhism or doing something, your chances are you'd be meditating more than most monks meditate in Thailand and Sri Lanka and places like that. Probably because a lot of you watch a lot of TV. But you have to say just a quarter of that time, right? So... Anyway, so much I could say, right? This is a big topic. Is that enough for now, or do you want someone else want to ask more about that topic? Or
I have a question. My name is Manny. This is the first time I came.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. First time. I'm visiting a Buddhist temple, and I have two major questions. First one, why are you not wearing orange?
I like blue.
You like blue? Okay.
I guess the question is not why I'm not wearing orange, but you think that Buddhist monks usually wear, in our tradition, the Theravada tradition, monks wear orange or saffron or brown robes, and I'm not wearing any robes because I'm not a monk.
Oh, okay.
I'm a layperson, and one of the characteristics of, this kind of Buddhism that we learned in Thailand and Burma tended for the most part to be monastics led. There were monks who led it. And the teachers who taught us didn't require us to be monks. And so when we were taught in Asia, and then we came back here and started teaching here, there was no expectation that we were supposed to be monks as teachers. And so what happened, what's kind of new in Buddhism, it's pretty new, it's happened a few times before in history, but it's happening in a big way here in the modern West. And it's a radical change from the history of Buddhism, where in our growing insight meditation movement, the kind of Buddhism that we do here, it's one strand, one school of Buddhism, the great, great, great majority of the teachers are lay people who are married, have kids, some of them, and that's creating a different flavor and different like almost teachings, too, about what Buddhism and what the emphasis is. And so that's a whole new change. And so in that change, I'm not a monk. That's why I don't wear.
Okay. Yeah, and you answer my second question, if you were allowed to get married.
if I was a monk, I would have to be celibate and not be married. But as a layperson, it's fine.
Okay.
Fine enough.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions on how to move from pity to true compassion?
So how to move from pity, and so why? Why are you asking the question? Or what's the issue with pity that you have?
Well, first is that I hear it's the near enemy to compassion, so it sounds like there's a conflict between them.
Uh-huh.
But second of all, I mean, it seems that compassion is really coming from a place of empathy, right?
Empathy?
Right. Uh-huh. Whereas pity seems like I feel sorry for you, so there's a disconnection between me and the person I'm thinking about versus compassion, where I believe that we're the same, right?
So pity is a hierarchy, looking down at someone, feeling sorry for them as if you're better or something.
Right. But a lot of times my mind is first goes to pity sometimes, and so I'm wondering if you have tips on how to... I mean, I know being mindful of it is definitely a huge component, but it's something I've been struggling with a lot lately.
Uh-huh. Great. Great question. So one of the, in our particular tradition of Buddhism, where we emphasize a lot of mindfulness, mindfulness itself can help you with that. Because if you develop a heightened sensitivity, heightened empathy to yourself, heightened sensitivity to what's actually going on inside of you when you have pity, you'll see that you're suffering. You'll see that's painful. It's a contracted state to have pity. It's kind of like you're holding yourself tight and distant and separated. And so you become your own teacher. You kind of feel from the inside the stress of that, the tension of that, and it just doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. You also feel that you also can feel, that, literally feel, how it doesn't really feel good, the relationship you have with someone else. If you get more skilled at this mindfulness and see the subtleties of it, you'll see that to have that kind of pity for someone means that your mind has been engaged in an activity of creating self and other, creating a self identity, who I am versus that person. And that's also work, and it's, you know, in the long term it's exhausting. It also feels limiting to do that. Compassion is more of a natural flow of the heart that doesn't require any sense of self and other being different or one better than the other or construct of self-identity in relationship to it. And so compassion by itself doesn't have to involve distress, doesn't have to involve contraction, tension, stress, self-identity issues, thinking I'm different than someone else. It just has to be an open heart. And so there's no suffering in compassion. There might be some pain, you know, empathic pain, but what in Buddhism we call there's no suffering. So you can feel that for yourself, and by feeling it for yourself, it gives you the doorway or points you in the direction of where you can make a difference. And you're going to make a difference and keep going into it with mindfulness, keep going into that suffering. And if you go into the suffering, you'll come out of it the other end. And that, I think, is if you're able to do that, that's a very, very effective way to deal with it. Because it's getting to the roots, it's getting directly into the issue itself. As opposed to someone giving you good advice and pointing out, you know, pity is not a good idea and you're holding yourself separate and above someone and you should really kind of see yourself as equal to someone else, that will help. That's a good advice in a sense, but that can be interpreted as just more activity and ideas and interpretations to put on top. And then it's just like we're just moving the deck chairs around the Titanic, you know, getting things just right. and as opposed to just, you know, just being open and present. Does that make sense? Is that a meaningful answer for you? Or?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Gil, I have a question.
Yeah.
Right over here. You spoke of intention earlier.
Yes.
And can you talk a little?
Where's that person?
It's CB over here.
Oh.
Catherine. Your old friend.
Yeah, it's
good. Intention, some learning more about that. With the DPP program?
You're learning more about it, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the focus of this month's teachings, and I'd, it would be helpful to hear a little more about working with moment-to-moment intention and volition.
Yeah, it's a good
so
one.
The relationship between the two and how one might, I mean, really, when the practice hits the road with intention, what does that look like and how to cultivate it?
So I think that there are layers of intentionality, there are sense of purpose or motivations that we have. And so at the largest level is of what is our life going to be about? Do we have an overarching intention? Do we have a central intention? Do we have a core intention that we're most important that we want to orient our life around? This is what primary thing I want my life to be about. It's not necessary to have that, but some people really have that. And, what are the important senses of purpose that I want my life to be about? So for that, sometimes it takes time to reflect, go be by yourself, have tea, look out the window, and reflect, what is my deepest intention for myself? I spent, I think, a year of my life asking myself that question every day. What's my deepest intention? And so for many days I got the same answer, but some days it changed and morphed as I went into it and explored it. So I think kind of taking time to really quality time to keep asking, what is my deepest intention? And you can ask it for my life, but you can also ask it for the day. Another practice I've done is at the beginning of the day, some point in the beginning of the day, to look at what is the intention that I want this day to be about. So to be kind of anticipatory. So this day I'm doing X, Y, and Z. What would I like this day to be about? What would I like X to be about? Y to be about? You know, different things would be. What's my intention? There was a period of time where I used to have one of those written date books. You know, you wrote in both. Remember those times? And I would sometimes in the beginning of the day look at the things that I had listed that I was going to do for the day. And then I would spend time thinking about what intention do I want to bring to that activity? Because there was always some intention. Like, for example, I can go shopping, right, for my family, grocery shopping. And someone says, what's your intention in going shopping? I'm buying food for my family. That's the intention. But that's a lost opportunity to leave it there. You could imbue it sincerely and meaningfully with more intentions, more kind of sense of purpose of going shopping. I'm going to buy food for my family in order to care for them better, to express my love, to come home with a spirit of generosity to them. And so then I go shopping with a little different attitude, and I come back with a different attitude, an attitude that's more conducive to opening my heart and maybe their hearts. I could go shopping with the intention, I'm going to go into this big supermarket and I'm going to see if I can make be friendly to any people I run into there. Can I go in there and not just kind of be grumpy? I've gone to supermarkets and been grumpy the whole time. whatever. I have other more important things to do, and why am I doing this or something, Who knows why? But go in and have an intention. Can I go in and even make a difference in someone else's life in the supermarket? Maybe the cashier. Can I say hello nicely and smile? I get the person to smile. Can I make a difference in someone's life in a good way going in there? And so then it's you're shopping, yes, to bring food home. But now you've imbued it with other things at the same time. And so anyway, so proactively to think ahead, what am I about to do? And what would I like this to be about? And not to set it up as something, some moralistic standard that you can fail at, and feel really bad about yourself. It's extra credit. And so it's nice if it happens, but you know, it doesn't have to happen. So you don't use this to beat yourself up if you don't do it. If you go to the supermarket and you're just as grumpy leaving, worse leaving you went in. It isn't like, you know, you don't have to worry about having failed this, your higher intention. But it's good to have, you know, but if you have this higher or other intentions, you infuse your life with it, your life becomes richer. It becomes more multidimensional. And so much follows in the wake of having an intention. Without an intention, not much is going to happen. And so have an intention and learn how to have intentions wisely and hold them lightly, and but to have them if inform you. So proactively think ahead what you're going to do. And then there's also looking at the intention moment by moment, which you mentioned, this moment by moment. So there's many situations in life where it's good to pause and look, why am I doing this? What am I trying to accomplish? So conversations are great, and they're hard in conversations, but one of the great questions around intentions when you're talking with people is, why do I want to say this? If you ask that question every time before you speak, you'll be enlightened quickly. Because what drives our speech, so much of it is subconscious. There's so many intentions, so many purposes we have that are not just the surface thing. And we want to make an impression in a certain way. We want to accomplish certain things. We want to change the world in certain ways. We want to get people to behave better according to how we want. If we start looking more deeply, why am I saying this? Why am I really saying this? What purpose? Look at the intentionality, the motivation behind our speech acts. By why am I saying this? Don't be content with the first answer that you have, because if you ask, you know, why are you telling someone something? Oh, I'm just answering their question. That's my motivation, is to answer their question. But why are you answering their question? Oh, well, because I think that if I answer the question, then, you know, she'll go out on a date with me, or whatever, right? So if you have one motivation, one intention, then ask yourself the question, and why do I have that intention? What's the purpose of having that intention? So you can sometimes go through the layers that way. And so, checking in with yourself periodically through the day, what is the intention I have in doing this thing? What am I trying to accomplish? What's the purpose here? And sometimes it's a little bit embarrassing, a little bit eye-opening to realize you haven't actually infused it with a sense of purpose. And what's happening then is you're an automatic pilot. Then you have kind of more the emotional background of your life fueling it. And sometimes not just, you know, your own background conditioning that's unconsciously fueling why you're doing what you're doing. But there's a lot of people who get paid a lot of money in America to influence how you behave. And if you're not infusing it with your own intentionality, then these advertisers and the media and politicians and everyone is trying to get in there into your brain and getting you to behave certain ways. So stop and looking. What am I, you know? And so it can be as simple as driving your car. What is the purpose? What's the intention as you drive your car? And you can look at yourself, how I'm driving right now. You can ask yourself, look at yourself, what intention do I already have? Or what are the intentions? Because it could be multiple intentions at the same time. Oh, I'm driving to the store. But what's your intention? What's the intention? What other intentions are you fueling it with? I have the intention of getting there as quickly as I can, because fast is good. Or intention is to try to get through as many traffic lights without stopping as possible. You know? And yellow means green. So you can see, I was looking at what are you doing when you drive? And if you really start questioning, you know, realizing I'm driving, is there any intention I want to bring to driving? Then you might bring a different intention than if you don't ask the question. If you don't ask the question, you might be operating subconsciously. So keep asking, what is the intention I want to do when I drive? Maybe, do you want to drive in such a way to make the roads a nicer place for other people. That's one way. That's one way I try to drive, is how do I drive in such a way that other people have a better driving experience? As opposed to, all those people are in my way. Get out of my way, you guys. Give me a better experience. So does that give you plenty of stuff to work with? And
yes, thank you very much.
Intention is a great topic. So one more, please. Did we have a mic? Oh, yes, Julie.
Hi, Gil. So one of my main practices right now is forgiveness. And I'm finding that certain stories or certain parts are particularly sticky. So could you comment, or I'd be interested in hearing some of the common pitfalls or snags, or maybe some of your experiences of pitfalls and snags along the way to an open heart, and how to work with, just how to work with, how to, some approaches and how to work.
Great. So you're working with forgiveness, but this forgiveness is needed because some event that happened in the past, which you can review in your mind, that's a story, right? But some of those stories are sticky or snags, or, you know, you can maybe forgive some ways, but then you remember certain parts of the story and so how to work with that. One of the things that I've learned, this is a big topic, so I don't have much time now, but anyway, you asked about what I've learned, my own experience. I've learned that in both letting go of resentment and anger, which is a big part of forgiveness, the purpose of forgiveness is to let go of our anger and resentment, and letting go of it, if I don't have any joy in the letting go, it'll come back and bite me. Because I've forgiven, I've let go, I thought I did, but I just ended up feeling neutral. And if I'm neutral, you know, then I haven't really let go or haven't really forgiven in some deeper way. So I've learned to look for the joy or the well-being or the delight or the so kind of a good feeling in the letting go, a good feeling with the forgiveness. And then I have more confidence that it's really been a change inside. So there's that. I think some people find it helpful in doing forgiveness to actually realize that it's about letting go of your anger and resentment as opposed to benefiting the person you're forgiving. If it's all about benefiting for them, then it can be more sticky because they don't deserve it. And some of them don't. That's for sure. But it's not good for you to go around being angry and resentful. You know, it's like you just, you know, what they say, what the Buddha said, to paraphrase him, is that if you're angry, you're doing your enemy's work. You know, you're just causing more and more suffering. Suffering keeps going on. You know, they've gone on for, they don't even know who you are anymore. And, you know, they couldn't care less. But, you know, they don't have to know who you are anymore because you're doing their work for them. You're just getting, you know, you riled up and get angry and tight and upset and you feel hurt. And so to understand that the important part of forgiveness is to free yourself of the anger and resentment that you have.
A quick follow-up.
Yeah.
So is it the same approach for forgiveness of self or others and forgiveness of, like, the Dharma, the way things are?
Forgiveness of the Dharma?
The state of the world.
you want to forgive it?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, sometimes I think there is... Yeah, the condition of...
Yeah, forgive the world. That's a generous thing to want to do. Thank you. There's no need to be angry at the world. So one of the things that really helps, especially when it's like global kind of issues like the state of the world and all that, is I think that I don't know about you, I don't know how somebody, but sometimes when there's anger, when there's grief about all this, sometimes it comes from a lack of confidence, a lack of feeling that you can make any kind of difference at all. And so sometimes it's useful to go look at confidence. Look at one's confidence. Look at where you feel lack of confidence, where you feel confident, and perhaps the forgiveness that you're looking for can only happen in a realistic way when you have a little bit more self-confidence, a sense of efficacy. Not that you're going to solve the world's problems, but some kind of efficacy. So I hope this was nice, I mean, meaningful for you to do questions this way. It was not very nice for me to hear from you, your concerns. And coming down here to give this talk today, I've been away a little bit, quite a bit, this last month or two. And I said, well, I don't know what these people are interested in. So I don't know, I shouldn't go down and just assume. So it would be nice to hear from you and hear what your questions. So hopefully those of you who didn't ask questions, or even those who, especially those who did, it was nice for you to have the questions and answers and discussion. So I appreciate it. Thank you all very much.